Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Borisaj, veteran political organizer and co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who looks at the life and legacy of U.S. Senator Paul Wellstone, killed in a plane crash on October 25th. Steve Cobble of the Center for International Policy, who assesses the landslide election victory of Workers' Party candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who will be sworn in as Brazil's next president January 1st. And Dr. Maria Acosta, human rights lawyer and coordinator of the Center for Legal Assistance for Indigenous Peoples in Nicaragua, who talks about her husband's recent murder and international concern for her continued safety. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new United Nations report accuses dozens of multinational corporations like Barclays Bank and De Beers of abetting the plunder of the Democratic Republic of Congo. More specifically, the UN special report says 85 corporations based in the United States, Europe, and South Africa violated international standards on business ethics by aiding criminal networks, often led by local military commanders, in ravaging the Congo in recent years and helping fuel the bloody civil war there. According to a report in the Guardian newspaper, these multinational companies had a direct hand in plundering natural resources like gold, diamonds, cobalt, and copper. The stolen resources were worth billions of dollars to big mining companies and financial institutions. François Grignon, a Central African staffer for the International Crisis Group, praised the UN report. "These corporations must accept responsibility," he said. "They benefit more in this dirty business than those doing the digging and mining." The report also strongly condemns the African nations that sent troops into the Congo during the civil war and who refused to withdraw after a peace treaty was signed. These militias continued to loot natural resources and made huge war profits. Prior to the October sniper murders that terrorized citizens in Metro Washington, D.C., the National Rifle Association was riding high. The NRA had intimidated Democrats into dropping gun control as a major issue and largely had its way in Congress. The NRA has a reliable ally in Attorney General John Ashcroft, the top recipient of NRA political contributions in the 2000 election. According to The Nation magazine, the NRA has worked hard in recent years to become a central cog in the Republican political machine. And it worked hard to increase links with the Bush inner circle by naming Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform and David Keene of the American Conservative Union as board members. Despite all its clout, the NRA so far has a mixed record in the 2002 election outside of its rural conservative base. In the Pennsylvania governor's race, the NRA backed Bob Casey Jr., who was easily beaten by former Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell, who backed a lawsuit against gun makers to recover the public expenditures related to gun violence. Rendell is expected to win this November's election. Khalid Pitts of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence finds that in moderate districts, the NRA is an albatross around the necks of candidates they support because they've been so extremist and recalcitrant in blocking common sense things like requiring background checks at gun shows. In recent years, racial profiling has become a highly visible civil rights issue. Many activists and some politicians have condemned the widespread practice of local or state police officers who, with no pretext other than skin color, stop African-American drivers in large numbers. In suburban Detroit, another form of racial harassment came to light. Local police were stopping black teenagers on bicycles. It started in 1995 for two brothers, Charlie and Devon King, as they rode their bikes to a neighborhood store in the town of East Point, Michigan. They were stopped by a police officer and asked for identification. Finding no violations, the boys were quickly released. A few weeks later, the King brothers were stopped again by the police outside a Kmart store, with the police car sirens screaming and lights flashing. According to Mother Jones magazine, soon afterwards, the boy's father, Charles King Sr., complained to town officials and filed two discrimination lawsuits for racial harassment. In response to the lawsuits, evidence was revealed that the local chief of police had ordered police officers to stop all African-American youths riding their bikes around East Point. Now lawyer Charles Choman has filed a class action discrimination lawsuit on behalf of 21 African-American youths who were stopped by cops while riding their bicycles. They are seeking $21 million in damages, more police training, and an end to profiling of African-American youths on bikes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
For many progressive activists, Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone represented the leading edge of what was possible in U.S. electoral politics. Against all odds, Wellstone, a college professor, ran a quirky, underfunded campaign against a Republican incumbent for U.S. Senate in 1990 and actually won. He triumphed over big money and traditional politics by touring Minnesota in an old green school bus, airing clever but inexpensive TV ads, and more importantly, making a strong connection with voters hungry for an honest representative who would look out for their interests in Washington. In the closing days of a hotly contested campaign for a third term in the Senate, Wellstone, his wife, daughter, three campaign aides, and two pilots were killed when their small plane crashed in rural Minnesota. The outpouring of tributes to Paul Wellstone's integrity after his passing, even from his political opponents, was affirmation that he was unique among politicians for holding on to his idealism. Wellstone was the only senator facing a tight race to cast a vote against a congressional resolution authorizing President Bush a free hand to declare war against Iraq. Defying dire warnings from pollsters predicting that his principled stand against war could jeopardize his reelection, Wellstone had pulled ahead of his GOP opponent Norm Coleman in the days before he died. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with veteran political organizer Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future, who talks about the qualities that set Paul Wellstone apart from most other politicians in the Democratic Party. He also discusses the emerging peace movement, whose organizers and major demonstrations across the country October 26th frequently invoked the late senator's name, one of the few in the halls of power who openly embraced their cause.
Because he always believed that mobilization could match money, Paul was independent. He was always able to stand up and fight for what he believed in, and he fought for working and poor people. He fought for affordable health care, for the minimum wage, for corporate reform, for public financing of campaigns. He cast courageous votes. He was somebody who always believed that if you made your case to people, they could hear you even if they disagreed with you and respect you because you were voting your beliefs. So in 1996, Newt Gingrich was pushing welfare reform, which was really an assault on poor women and immigrants. President Clinton vetoed the bill twice, but his pollster told him that if he vetoed it a third time, he'd lose. Republicans would beat him up with it, and he'd lose votes in the election of 96. And so Clinton basically caved to a bill that he later admitted was unconscionable. Paul was up for election that year, too, and knew that he would be burlesqued as a defender of welfare queens if he voted against the bill. But he couldn't stomach the provisions that were in it. He was a son of an immigrant. He couldn't believe the anti-immigrant prejudice that was involved in the bill. He hated the notion that it would be that punitive to the most vulnerable people, poor mothers and their children. And he basically couldn't go along with the big lie that the problem was welfare rather than poverty. So he voted against it even in the midst of his reelection campaign. And, of course, he did the same thing this year with the vote on the Iraq war resolution, where he was the only senator in a contested race that was prepared to vote against a rush to war that many of them thought was wrong-headed and unfortunate. Part of his legacy certainly is the willingness to stand up and lay out and fight for working and poor people and basic principles. Part of it is the political strategy of building a base of activists and of mobilization that could keep you independent from, you know, having to depend on the entrenched interests that fund campaigns in this country.
Bob Borisage, even corporate media, in noting the death of Paul Wellstone, pointed out that through his career, principles often triumphed over polls and politics. But reflections on that also bring into the idea that there is inherent weakness in the Democratic Party. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, you know what I was struck by the commentary is most of these pundits have really paid tribute to Paul's liberalism, but painted it as sort of a throwback to an old party and that the new party was moving to the center and had abandoned his politics. I actually think that's profoundly mistaken, that Paul's politics really pointed the way to the party's future, not its past. That is, he combined the two elements that create the potential for forging a majority for progressive reform in this country. One was the values and the sensibilities of the movements, of the kind of triumphant values and sensibilities of the movements of the 60s on women's rights, on civil rights, on the environment. And that was central to what formed Paul, and it has now become the majoritarian sentiment across the country. And he wedded that to what he called, long before it became a pollster's phrase, the kitchen table issues that his constituents would talk to him over coffee in Minnesota, the concerns about wages and about job security and about social security and health care and education. And Paul understood from those conversations that that was the agenda that would appeal to people, whatever their social values, whether they were conservatives or liberals, that people had real everyday struggles that you had to fight for. And that combination is, I believe, not the past of American, of the Democratic Party, but is the only future that offers it the promise of being able to create a majority that can actually affect reform in this society.
At peace demonstrations October 26th around the country, Paul Wellstone's name was invoked quite often. And I wonder, how do you assess the relative strengths and weaknesses of the emerging peace movement that's challenging the Democratic leadership and the White House drive for a new war in the Persian Gulf?
Well, of course, this is the strangest peace movement that we've seen, in the sense that the opposition is so widespread before the war starts, even though there's no draft. You know, you've had over 200 teach-ins on campuses. You've got these rallies of tens of thousands of people in San Francisco and Chicago and Washington and elsewhere. You've got an extraordinary outpouring of sentiment from the highest elite levels, you know, half the Republican foreign policy establishment, down to places that really haven't been involved in politics before, all before the war starts. And so this is much different than Vietnam. The level of opposition here and concern here is much broader, I think, and much more energized, certainly, than it was at the similar time in Vietnam. This is like almost 67 in Vietnam after the war had gone bad, this level of opposition. It's, I think, incredibly vital that this opposition voice spread, that it be voiced by people of all walks of life at all stations, that we have both activism and, you know, elite petitions. I think these things are very important in possibly fending off a rush to a war that this country is certainly not ready to undertake.
That was Robert Borisage, co-founder of the Campaign for America's Future. Contact the campaign by calling area code 202-955-5665 or visit their website at www.ourfuture.org. In his fourth run for Brazil's presidency, Workers' Party candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva won an historic landslide victory, capturing 61% of the votes in the October 27th runoff election. Lula, as he's known across Brazil, will be sworn into office January 1st, becoming his nation's first popularly elected leftist leader. Da Silva captured the hearts of many Brazilians for his unlikely journey to power. After growing up in poverty, Lula became a factory lathe operator, eventually rising to lead the Metal Workers Union. He gained a reputation for courage as he defied Brazil's rightist military dictatorship in power between 1964 and 1985, and was jailed by the generals for leading a series of worker strikes. Lula comes into office pledging to improve the lives of Brazil's 50 million citizens now living in poverty. In his first speech after the election, the president-elect announced that his top priority will be to reduce hunger, But with the nation's finance sector uneasy about a Workers' Party government, Lula has tried to assure bankers and industrialists that he will balance his fight for social justice with fiscal responsibility. Brazil's $260 billion debt and a steep devaluation of the currency are among the most formidable challenges faced by the working class leader. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Cobble, senior fellow with the Center for International Policy, who assesses the significance of Lula's victory and the impact his Workers' Party government may have on Latin America and the world.
A victory of this size, to put it in context, it's a landslide victory. We might call him landslide Lula now. This is a victory of a magnitude of, in the United States terms, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson's in 1964, or Nixon's and Reagan's second elections, a very big victory. In fact, Lula won more actual votes than George Bush did in 2000. And this is in a nation with 100 million fewer people. So that gives you some size of the magnitude of his win. And it should be a strong argument on the legitimacy front when Lula starts negotiating with the United States about the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, which is going to be one of the first interesting points of probable disagreement. Brazil is very much opposed to the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas as it currently exists. Almost all sectors of the Brazilian economy, and it's almost unanimous across the board, they don't like it. Lula scored heavily with his theme of Brazilian dignity, Brazil taking its place among the major nations of the world. And I think the Free Trade Agreement now has some new obstacles. That's a very important difference. The other thing I think is Brazil will probably become one of the leaders of the opposition to what Latin Americans call the Washington Consensus, which is the neoliberal globalization programs, which are essentially unfettered free trade, unfettered corporate free trade might be a better way to put it.
Lula faces some looming obstacles, including billions of dollars in debt and a currency devaluation. How will he approach these problems and obstacles, do you think? And is he set up for failure given the huge challenge ahead for him?
Well, there is that possibility. The one thing about Lula that's interesting is this is his fourth try for the presidency. It was probably better for him and for the Workers' Party that they didn't win on the first try, although he came close back in 1989. Since then, he's gained much more experience in high-level politics, and his party has had experience at governing several states and cities. And I think they're much better equipped to try to handle the balancing act that it's going to take. He has indicated that he'll probably appoint a conservative to the central bank, but he's also indicated that he wants the government budget to favor the poor people of Brazil, who have always gotten the short end of the stick. In fact, Brazil is known as one of the, like the U.S. actually, as one of the nations with the highest gap between rich and poor. Lula has said he's going to address that, and he'll have to try to address that because that's why most of the people who voted for him did so. He can't just do what the IMF demands. He's going to have to make some moves toward the poor people of the country, and I think he wants to. I mean, this is a man who earlier in his life risked death from the military junta when he defied their injunction and led his union on strike. And one of the penalties for defying the injunction was death, and he led them out on strike anyway. So this is not a man who's short on courage, and I think he'll have to do some interesting political balancing, but I think he's capable of it.
Just a final question. Brazil has the ninth largest economy in the world, a big player. With Lula at the helm of the nation of Brazil, what is the potential, in your view, of alliances across the globe between Brazil and nations like South Africa and other major developing nations to sort of shift the Washington consensus agenda that you referred to earlier? Is there a hope that with Lula in the presidency of Brazil that there may be sort of a realignment around the globe?
That's one of the reasons why Lula's victory is going to be so interesting and why there is cause for some optimism. The biggest gap in the world, as we all know, is basically between North and South in wealth and power and environmental carbon dioxide production and things like that. Lula's victory is the biggest victory for a left-leaning, democratically elected leader since Mandela. I mean, this is a former union president, former political prisoner, heading the Workers' Party in Brazil, and he wins with more than 3 out of 5 of the votes over the government's candidate. So that's a very interesting outcome, and I think it does offer some potential to do some realignment to help provide a more vocal voice for the poorest people in the Southern Hemisphere. And to a lot of us, that's a good thing.
That was Steve Cobble, Senior Fellow with the Center for International Policy. Contact the center by calling area code 703-531-1183 or visit their website at www.cionline.org. On April 8th, Francisco Garcia Valle, a well-known university professor in Bluefields, Nicaragua, was viciously murdered in his home and was found bound, gagged, and shot in the chest. At the time, his wife, Dr. Maria Luisa Acosta, was meeting with a delegation from Pastors for Peace. Dr. Acosta is an internationally renowned attorney and has received threats to her physical safety in the past because of her work on behalf of indigenous communities struggling to keep their land and protect basic human rights. In September, a forensics expert traced one of the bullets which killed Valle to a weapon registered to Peter Martinez, attorney for Peter Socos, an American citizen and real estate developer who claims he purchased the Pearl Cays, 7 small islands off the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, for $30,000. Since then, Socos sold some of the islands for $500,000 each. But this land was guaranteed to local indigenous communities under the Nicaraguan Constitution and the 1988 Atlantic Coast Autonomy Act. Despite these laws, the courts of Nicaragua have been accused of ignoring these rights and collaborating with U.S. corporations to privatize and sell indigenous people's lands. Dr. Acosta represents the autonomous region of the South Atlantic Coast against Socos. She spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Banzari about her husband's murder and international concern for her continued safety.
I've been working for about 10 years now, defending indigenous land rights on the ethnic communities of the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. We are trying for the National Assembly to pass a bill that creates this law, the demarcation law. But in the meantime, there are some individuals that are trying to get some titles over indigenous land rights and that have been trying to sell the land. And that's how we have been suing them and trying to detain them from doing this.
Traditionally and typically in areas of Latin America, it's kind of a dangerous prospect, the work that you're doing to defend the rights of indigenous peoples.
Yes, it is. You know, we've been doing this for 10 years, and we have been working with the law, trying to give the opportunity to indigenous to work through the system. And we see that as an important role for democracy and to have the right to be treated equally as any other landowner in our society.
Your husband, Maria, was president of the Bluefields Chamber of Commerce and professor at the University of the Autonomous Regions of the Caribbean Coast, otherwise known as Huracan. Do you want to talk a little bit about his work? Was he involved in the same work that you're doing?
No, he was not involved. He used to teach, actually, these individuals who tried to kill me. They got into my house, they broke into my house, and they were looking for me. They couldn't find me. They found my husband, and then they killed him. And that was a message for me. They were looking for me to deter me from working with the indigenous leaders defending indigenous land rights.
Who do you think is responsible for the murder of your husband?
There are 3 men that I had rented an apartment to them, and since the killing, they disappeared. And nobody's in jail. We have identified only one of them, whose name is Ivan Arguello Rivera. but the other two we have not been able to identify. These men came from the other side of the country. They've been there for 15 days, you know, surveilling the house, surrounding the house. And in order to get out of Bluefields, the place where this happened, you have to do it through the airport or through boat. According to some witnesses, some indigenous peoples that I work for, they saw a man using Peter Sokos, a Greek man who's selling in indigenous land through internet boat, carrying some strangers, and when they were seen, they tried to hide. Regarding that, we have also find out that this Ivan Arguello Rivera was a bodyguard and chauffeur of Peter Sokos by the time my husband was killed. The police found out that the bullet that killed my husband was the gun that belongs to Peter Martinez, the lawyer for Peter Sokos, who was also involved in the selling of indigenous lands.
Do you want to explain to the listeners, Maria, where Bluefields, Nicaragua is exactly for those that may not know?
Bluefields is located in the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua. It's a town of 40,000 people. We're surrounded by water and forest, and there is no road to go there. It's a very remote place in Nicaragua where indigenous and African Nicaraguan communities are located.
You were in New York on the weekend of October 25th, 26th. Do you want to talk about what you were doing in New York?
I was granted an award of the 35th anniversary of IFCO and Pastors for Peace.
And then you're going to go back to Nicaragua and carry on your work. How are you continuing to do this after what happened to your husband? I mean, do you have protection?
I have moved to the other side of the country, and I have some lawyers locally. And I do a lot of my work through internet, through email, but we continue protecting the indigenous land rights, human rights, but at the same time we're trying to get to the bottom of the case. We are even trying to take the case to Inter-American Commission on Human Rights because of the lack of response that we have been having from the Nicaraguan judges, especially from Bluefield judges, to press the government and the police to give me an impartial judge, which I haven't had.
That was Dr. Maria Luisa Acosta, human rights attorney in Nicaragua. For more information about the case, call area code 212-926-5757 or visit the website at www.ifconews.org/Nicaragua. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.